You are listening to the MJ Murdoch Charitable Trust's 2019 Leadership Advance Conference. The theme of the conference was listening to others, hearing the voices of our neighbors. This evening's session introduces Speaker Jeremy Courtney, President and Founder at Preemptive Love.
I'm going to invite Kimberly Thornberry. Where can Kimberly go? There she is. Kimberly is coming to us from New York City, where she's been the Vice President of Strategic Planning and Enrollment Services and a variety of other leadership roles there at a college there. And before that was at Union University in Tennessee and has a career in Christian higher education. So Kimberly is going to introduce our speaker tonight. And also I wanted you just to be sure and get to know Kimberly. So let's welcome Kimberly up as well. Yeah. Welcome.
Thank you. Well, thank you, Steve. Well, allow me to begin this introduction of Jeremy Courtney by talking about what he and his team were up to while most of us were lazing around over the Thanksgiving holiday. We all know there's a crisis on the southern border, and most of us talk about it while Jeremy and his dedicated band of aid workers are coming up with practical and life-changing solutions. Specifically, they're hard at work to place tech buses on the border for refugees who, in Jeremy's words, can't go back and can't go forward because of the perilous and violent situations just outside the shelters. The Wi-Fi-equipped buses is designed to be a safe harbor where refugees can get legal advice and have a safe place where they can work and be paid for jobs that they do online on the bus. That's just one example of the far-ranging mission of the relief organization that Jeremy founded a decade ago to deal with the humanitarian crisis that erupted in the wake of the Iraq War. It's called Preemptive Love. And rather than just reacting to these crises as they arise, Preemptive Love goes in early and stays for the long haul. And Jeremy, his wife Jessica, and children, they walk the walk. When ISIS erupted in 2014, spreading their campaign of horror, the Courtneys stayed in Iraq and gave relief to refugees and provided life-saving operations and medical aid and food and shelter. And they're doing this all around the world in really hard places. And they're providing the sort of neighbor love that puts life and limb at risk for the other. In my words, he is the real deal. And after this short video, will you please join me in welcoming the president and founder of Preemptive Love, Jeremy Courtney. Thank you.
Good evening. You guys have been through a lot today already, and I got to tell you, I've been shot at by ISIS and stuff like that, but this is a rather intimidating room to be in front of tonight. So let me just get that out there. You're not an easy crowd to want to try and, help guide through this morass that we seem to find ourselves in this time and place and cultural moment that we're in together right now. But let me walk back and see if I can give some context for where I'm coming from tonight. I don't have some sugar stick kind of message that I give everywhere I go, so I'm going to just try and make it up with you as we go tonight in the context of what you've been through already today, what we've been talking about. I didn't know a lot about Islam on September 10th, 2001. I imagine a lot of us didn't know very much about Islam on September 10th, 2001. But come September 11th, it seemed to be all we talked about, right? And that's not entirely true. I did know that Muslims were going to hell. I did know that Muslims hated us. I knew that they were scary and angry and most of all jealous of our way of life. I knew all that. But all that in spite of the fact that I didn't actually know any Muslims. I'd never met a Muslim. I'd never talked to a Muslim. I'd never asked them what they believe. I'd never asked them where they were coming from, you know, what they were aiming toward. I just took all that for granted. That was part of the milieu I grew up in. It was the worldview that was handed to me. And I knew it. It was the waters I swam in. It might be true for some of us in the room. And so on that morning of September 11th, when I had just gotten married in grad school, and I was walking down the halls of Baylor University to find out that this had gone down, I think looking back now, I realized that I was really primed for something. I was really ready to be mobilized and activated for something. I wanted to respond. And there were two kinds of people, as I remember, that responded where I was in Texas after those attacks on 9/11. Two kinds of people that went out into the world to try and make a difference. There were the military folks, and then there were the missionary folks. Some of us grabbed guns to go out and protect America. Some of us grabbed Bibles. And so I wasn't going to go the military route. I come from a military family, but that just didn't suit me. That wasn't the route I was going to end up going. I was in seminary at that time. I grabbed my Bible, grabbed my wife, and ultimately we ended up moving into what we called the Muslim world to respond, to make a difference, to make a change, to be a part of the solution. And 100%, to use the language that I think we would have used that day, that is the language of our day here today, to be good neighbors. To move in, to incarnate into their neighborhoods, and to be with them and to be among them. But, of course, I took a lot of baggage with me as I went. I was willing to take a step into the unknown at a time that really not very many people around me were willing to go into the scary Muslim world. We had a vision that took us out beyond the kind of shire that we grew up in and the worldview that we knew, but we brought a lot of baggage with us as we went. And so we landed in Turkey in the middle of this post-9/11 reality that a lot of us were kind of sorting our way through. The American empire it's been shown to be weaker than maybe we once thought it was. What I think happened on 9/11 is that our temples were destroyed. And like the Jewish temple being destroyed and the Jewish people then going on this wandering without identity and without place and without home and centeredness and anchoredness, I think that's what's been happening to the American people since 9/11. Our two temples were destroyed. Our temple to capitalism in New York City and our temple to nationalism and self-defense in Washington, D.C. And without those two temples, we didn't know where to worship anymore. And we weren't sure if our God was still with us anymore. And so I went traumatized in the world, as I think a lot of us did, to make a difference. We landed in Turkey, wanted to be a good missionary, wanted to plant churches. I mean this in the nicest way possible, Ibu, but I wanted to get rid of as many Muslims as possible by making them Christians. I mean, I didn't want their whole body to cease to exist in this world. I just wanted their identity to go away and be something completely different. And that was my daily task. That was my daily challenge. And after doing that for about 2 or 3 years, going out into the coffee shops and eating baklava and drinking tea and trying to like covertly and weirdly insinuate myself into people's lives so that I could tell them about Jesus, I ended up going to this missionary conference. We were all undercover. We were all lying to our neighbors about why we were there. We all had fake businesses and fake business cards. And we were essentially mirroring the practices of the 9/11 hijackers, but we were doing it in a Muslim context. So they came to our country, and they lied, and they took on false pretenses and false identities so that they could do something to us. And that was the best solution that we could come up with as well, was to go and lie and be duplicitous and kind of do the same in their context. We thought we were really clever. We thought the cloak and dagger stuff was like above them, and they wouldn't know what we were up to. But they were way smarter and way savvier than we understood. And they were onto us and suspicious of us and protective of their kids from the jump. So I'm at this missionary conference, we're all undercover, and we sneak into this underground kind of downstairs basement like this, and I end up crying out to God in prayer at this conference. I was full of zeal and passion and the truest, most sincere desire to see my Muslim neighbors cease to be the way they were and come to be a lot more like me. And I was crying out to God in prayer. I was face down on the ground. These church planting leaders that I really respected had asked us to take a break and pray. And I remember getting on the ground in prayer. And there had been success story after success story going on in this missionary conference all day long. I was feeling really insecure. And I was feeling like I was failing and all these other people were winning. And I knelt down in prayer and I just cried out to God, why? Why aren't you using me, God? Her? You're using her to actually make Muslims into Christians, but you're not using me? I'm so much smarter than she is. I speak the language better than she does. I do everything better than her, and she's got wins, and I don't have wins. And I'm crying all this out, face down, head on the ground in prayer. And for the first time in my life, probably, in prayer, something happened. I come from a Baptist background where I don't really know what to do with prayer. I don't really know what the point of it is. I don't know if it's supposed to accomplish something. I don't know if we pray and we're supposed to hear something, or I don't know if we're allowed to see the light, but I did. That's all I know to tell you. Something happened. And I'm face down on the ground. Why, God? And I heard, it's because you don't love them, Jeremy. Now, I don't know the fullness of what that meant. I don't know if it was my own ego betraying me, my own psyche. I don't know if it was God Almighty, the creator of the universe. I don't know. But how I experienced it at that time was that it was a word from on high that I was full of arrogance and that my heart was wrong for my neighbor. I thought I was so different than the guys who grabbed the guns and went out after 9/11 to destroy Muslims. Kill them all, let God sort them out, they said. I thought I was so different from that. I grabbed my Bible and I went out in this direction. But what that prayer and that moment taught me is that we had met on the other side of the ocean, and actually we were operating, some of us, I don't mean to cast aspersions across everyone, but the worldview that I'm talking about here, we had met on the other side, and we were both trying to accomplish a similar kind of thing, a world without Islam, a world without Muslims, a world a lot more like us. And so whether you eradicate it with this tool or you eradicate it with this tool, it revealed something in me. And I had to reckon with the fact, face down on the ground in prayer, I was much more of a conqueror, much more of a destroyer than I had ever imagined myself to be. I thought they were the destroyers and I was the generative one. That's not how it felt. That's not how it landed on me in prayer in that moment. Because you don't love them, Jeremy. Sure, you love Muhammad, the other guy sitting across from you at the chai table, the former Muslim, the guy you won, the guy you won to Jesus, notching your belt, the guy that you have a good story to go back and tell the donors, put in the newsletter. You love Muhammad, the former Muslim, but you don't love Muhammad for who he is right now, today, in front of you, full stop. It was very confronting. I'm still face down on the ground in prayer as this whole thing kind of washes over me. And as it comes, I see myself in my mind's eye for the first time, fists up. Why, God, why? Throwing punches. Throwing punches at God, throwing punches at my neighbor, protecting myself, defensive, aggressive. Why? Because you don't love them, Jeremy. This word comes and it washes over me and I see myself. My fists lower, and my hands slacken, and I open up into a position of vulnerability, openness, hospitality, embrace. I see this all playing out in my mind. It's all instantaneous. But as I stand up from that ground in prayer, back in this conference room with everyone else, I could tell it instantaneously. It was like an icy cage around my heart had melted. And I stood up and I was completely transformed. I never went out from that conference again to destroy. I never went out to conquer. I never went out to obliterate. I never went out to win like that. I didn't even get in the kinds of arguments that I got in before. I walked out of that conference and I was completely different. I have no idea when we started and when my time is due, just to make notes, so someone wave at me. But fast forward a little bit, and I ended up moving to Iraq. We were already en route to Iraq. We had already set our sights on Iraq when that moment happened. And had that moment not happened, had the heavens not opened up, or my head not peeked through into another layer of spiritual experience, or whatever it was, who knows what kind of person I would have been entering into Iraq. But as it happened, providence, grace, something unfolded in me, and by the time we landed in Iraq, I was a completely different person. Six, seven, maybe 8 years in, I can't remember now, 8 years in or something, this little known terror organization called ISIS springs onto the world stage, rampaging across Syria, rampaging across Iraq, ends up taking over a third of each country or more. And we've been living there for years. Making friends, making nice, making neighbors, living from kind of a different way of being. And moving into Iraq had forced me to confront a whole nother layer of bigotry and bias in my heart. It was one thing to love Turkish Muslims, but those Arabs? Like Arabs, they're the bad kind of Muslims. We all know that. Shia? I mean, they're the side that's with Iran. Sunni Arab? That's like a double X. Like, it's one thing to be Sunni Kurdish or Sunni Turkish, but Sunni Arab? Those are like all the Al-Qaeda guys. I didn't have to confront a lot of that stuff in Turkey. But in Iraq, finally, I was having to overcome more and more and more of that baggage that I brought with me. And we can talk about that a little bit more tomorrow and some stuff that we'll pick up. But suffice it to say for now that as ISIS rampaged its way across Iraq and Syria, displacing millions and millions and millions of people, they were running toward us. They were running toward our home, running toward our town, and to all the places that we lived and moved and where our friends and our work had already been for all those years. And we were just constantly inundated with waves and waves of people who needed everything that you and I need to be alive. They needed food and water and shelter and medicine, and ultimately they needed jobs and security and all that kind of stuff. We were completely ill-equipped to handle it. We didn't set up as an emergency aid organization. We didn't set up initially in Iraq to do job creation or help people rebuild after violence, but we learned because that's what our neighbors needed. That's what our neighbors needed. This was our home now. This wasn't just some place that we were passing through. It wasn't just some place that we were visiting. This was our neighborhood, and these were our people. And we learned how to get to work with them. And over the course of showing up on the front lines, what happens is ISIS would rush into a village or spring up from inside a village, drive a lot of people out, and basically occupy the village for everyone who stayed. Old people couldn't leave. Sick people couldn't leave. People with handicaps couldn't leave. And then some people just decided to stay. They were like, it's horrible out there too. So I'm going to rather die at home in my grandpa's house on our family land than go out there and face whatever unknown is out there as well. So there was a mixture of people that stayed, not all for ideological reasons. So ISIS would come to control these areas. You've heard of them. Aleppo, Raqqa, Mosul, Fallujah. And as they would occupy and hold this land, ultimately people would end up starved out. And healthcare and humanitarian services and all that kind of stuff would just get worse and worse and worse over the course of months and then years. And then eventually, the setting would be ripe for a military counterattack against ISIS. So then, after years of deprivation, the coalition would decide that now this is the next town to drive ISIS out of. So now, the military's coming in, and ISIS fighters are running out, and all the people who have been occupied and starved, they're running out as well. Back toward safety. We would run in with the firefight as people were running out to get free. And so for years of showing up on the front lines, getting shot at, getting bombed, it turned out that I had taken on a whole lot of new baggage. I wasn't prepared for seeing dead bodies in the street. I hadn't planned on getting shot. I didn't know how to cope with all that. We didn't have a big, you know, handbook in place that some psychologist had handed us before to say this is how you run an organization with new people and how you get shot at well. I don't know where that handbook is, but we didn't have it. And we come out of kind of the most intense season of some of this violence. And I remember standing in a church in Mosul. Early days. We were regularly embedded with the most elite military services in Iraq, and so we were regularly the first on the scenes in these places. And I remember going into a church, and we were walking through the remains of this church that ISIS had occupied and used as an auction block to sell off women into slavery. And I remember just someone said, "Watch out over there, they used to make bombs over there, so be careful, and there might still be tripwires." And I was just milling about as we do in some of these bombed out villages and bombed out buildings, and someone pointed up, and I looked up into the ceiling and saw the most glorious dome painting. Everything down here, everything around me was destroyed. Every icon, every cross, everything was gone. And up in the ceiling, the most glorious, perfect, pristine painting of Jesus, resurrected on the cross, resurrected sitting on a cloud, doling out peace and blessing. And I said, "Thank you, God, for reigning over it all." No, I didn't. I screamed and I cursed at God. "You sat up there in your pristine glory, untouched and unscathed, while all this went down here, while they sold little girls into the sex trade, you sat up there and did nothing?" And I left the church. Walked out. I hadn't been given a faith. Let me say it this way. My country club faith that I'd been given, my Disneyland faith that I'd been given, was not equipped for the ISIS world in which we were living. It just didn't match. It wasn't suited for the terrain that we were now walking. And so for the last number of years, I've been trying to find my way back in some ways, and I've been trying to find my way forward in a number of ways to say what I think a lot of us are saying, what a lot of us are realizing. And if you haven't put words to it yet, I think this is the thing that I want to just offer tonight as I wrap. It's a tool, it's a concept that I think we're all grappling with. And it's this reality that the maps that we've been given, that the maps that we've been using for many of us, don't seem to match the terrain that is beneath our feet anymore. And you may feel that with your peers. You may feel that with your neighbors who are of your age or of your ilk. If you spend any time with people half your age, you'll feel that exacerbated, that the age gap in how we navigate maps and terrain is significantly different. And it's accelerating and it's becoming more complex. And I think as we look out another 10 or 20 years from now, this thing that we're just now beginning to start to feel is going to be that much more pronounced and profound over the coming couple of decades. What is going to happen in technology, what is going to happen in biotech, is going to accelerate the level of dissonance and confusion between us, unlike anything that has happened over the last 10 or 20 years in what we have called the information age. It's going to be completely unprecedented, and we are not at this moment ideologically, spiritually, equipped. Our faith, as we've known it, for most of us, is not suited to what we are walking into. A lot of us think about our own personal growth, and therefore I think that the growth of society, in a kind of flatland view of the world. We're born into a time and place. We're born into a worldview. We're born into a culture. Mom and dad gave birth to us here. This is how grandma and grandpa lived. We did this ritual on weekends. This shaped us. We're all born into something, whatever it is, whether it's born into faith or born into anti-faith. We're all born into different things, right? And then we grow up. And we start disidentifying with that faith. We start challenging it. We start looking back on it. We start poking it and questioning it and walking away from it a little bit. For some of us, and some of what we hope for our neighbors, depending on who you are and where you sit in the room, you might hope your neighbors are moving from anti-faith to your version of faith. Or you might be a little bit like me, who feels like you've moved from a position of faith to another kind of faith, or a different kind of faith, or moved away from faith at a time. Whatever it is, that movement, for most of us, it takes place along this very flat kind of thing. And this is how we talk about polarity and partisanship and division in America today. We talk about this side, and we talk about this side. We talk about conservative, and then we talk about how woeful it is that people are moving away from conservative and moving to liberal. Or liberals talk about how woeful it is that there's all those crazy conservatives over there. Whatever it is, it's all very binary and flat, right? And it's exacerbated by the fact that when you're born into this, let's just use the conservative paradigm, because that's mine. We're born into conservatism, and you find yourself waking up to ideas. We use that word woke. You've heard that word. It comes from the notion of waking up. So you start waking up to new ideas, waking up to new realities that are progressive or more liberal. But as you start moving away from the one and disidentifying with it and moving toward the other, one feels very insecure. One feels, well, I'm not with them anymore. And I always used to fear them, and I'm not with them. And I know from when they're standing, looking back at anyone coming from that side of the road, this group is extremely suspicious, because everyone over there, we already know they're haters. We already know they're antiquated. We already know they're sick-minded. So all these people are fists up, scared, suspicious. So for those of us who are waking up, those of us who are moving on anything, politics, faith, religion, culture, cultural issues, and flashpoint stuff, any of this, as we're moving, we move to this kind of weird no man's land kind of thing, where we feel very insecure and we don't belong. We don't belong to them. We don't belong to them. So what we see in culture a lot right now is, in order to get this group's attention, and in the process of disidentifying with this womb that raised us, this group here in the messy middle starts over-identifying, over-acting out, over-performing. Hey, hey, look at me. I'm coming your way. I promise you can trust me. Look how woke I am. Look how much I'm like you. We're trying to get accepted. We're trying to find a new home as we disidentify with this. This, in my estimation, in my opinion, this sums up almost all of culture today. You're either born in a place and you stay there forever. Or you're born in a place and you start disidentifying and you're in the middle. Or you overperform and you end up in a new home and you're here. These are roughly our options. But there are more options available to us. And they exist not only in the identify, disidentify, but in the integration of that which has nurtured us. So eventually, at some point, we start looking back. If we keep developing, we look back on where we've come from, and we bless it. We thank it. We want it in our lives again. Even as we've once maybe rejected it or pushed away from it, we can look back on it and say, wow, bless the womb that raised me. Bless the womb that gave me birth. I'm so grateful for my mom and dad and that hometown and that religion and that church and that place I come from and that country and that nationalism and that worldview. It made me. It made me something, and it made us. And I'm glad it's a part of my story. And I bless this middle land and this middle place that I came through. And as we go through that process, forgive me, but I think it's necessary, it actually gets us up off the flat land, where everyone else is living on a flat X, Y, you know, kind of A, B polarization. What I think we need to reach into is to transcend above it, to rise above it, and come back to a middle place that's not, it's not the flat place in the middle. It's a transcended place in the middle, where you can actually feel like you still belong to this and it belongs to you. And you still belong to this and it belongs to you. But you're not over-identified or over-particular about any one of it, because you've seen the truth and the fallacy of all of it, in a way. These are some of my reflections from the front line. Some of what I'm trying to work my way through and what I think has been really helpful to me. I think it has bearing on where we're going. And I'll hope that we can get more into that tomorrow. But for now, I believe that this metaphor, this idea, that the maps that we've been holding don't match the terrain beneath our feet. That is a metaphor that I have found to be very true, and it's been resonant as I've traveled the country and talked about it and used the metaphor in other parts of the world. I'm by far not the only one using the metaphor, but I think the task ahead of us in loving our neighbor is to bring about new maps. That's really what we're trying to figure out here. And how do we do so when we imagine that the terrain beneath our feet isn't affected by the map. But what the map tells us defines where we go, in large part. And so then where we go actually changes the ground beneath our feet. And so we need to start taking a more holistic view of how all of this works together. And I just don't know if all of our institutions and all of our leadership and all of our organizations are quite geared up to that complex of a task right now. A lot of how we think about the world is we think that there is truth. And we, especially as Christian ministries and Christian leaders and Christian organizations, we can get so fixated on the truth. It's an objective thing. It sits out there in the world to be analyzed from all 360 degrees. It is the truth. It is unchangeable. And we must somehow comport and conform to it. But that's only one of the true perspectives about how the world actually works and how we actually work. We have an interior life from which we must live. We have a collective life together from which we must live. And we have collective culture that we go out and create together. And all of these things work together in a fulsome set of quadrants that I would love to encourage us to keep pressing into and try to lead from, not just the truth, but also what is our interior life like, and what is our internal culture like, and how are we bringing that culture to bear, and how does all that work together? Like I said, I don't have a sugar stick kind of canned thing that I do everywhere. I know that was for the first time, because I think what my particular journey and story has required is a willingness to poke my head into areas that I don't yet understand at all. And once I get a glimpse of those things, I think this is true for all of us, we get a glimpse of those things and then we decide, do I dare, having experienced that fear or that question or that peak moment of spirituality or insight, do I dare put my whole body through the curtain, through the membrane, into the next space, and fully live in that next space, whatever may come? I think that's what loving neighbor in the way that the conversation has been framed up for us today, I think, must entail. It can't just be a mere cozying up and kind of casual contact. That'll get us a certain distance. But the scarier thing, and therefore the more transformative thing, is to dare to poke our whole life through into the worldview of another and to dare live it like they live it, experience it like they experience it, in all the pain, in all the brutality, in all the beauty, in all the hopefulness, and to let their experience of the world inform and transform us. I want to pick up that conversation tomorrow, but it's been a long day for you, and I want to respect your time and your tired eyes. Thanks for letting me be with you for a few minutes tonight. Grateful for you. Thanks.